All right, everyone. It's Monday, February 24th. Lucky you. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It is a unbelievably beautiful day out there. I always give the weather report from Concord, New Hampshire. I don't care where you are. Houston, Michigan, North Carolina, I don't care. You got to know what the weather is here. One, it will also give you a sense of my mood. I didn't have to slip slide out the door. I didn't have to shovel to get here. Although I feel like I'm shoveling when it comes to politics. There is just such a pile of you know what. Anyway, it has been a very, very interesting and to some extent, how do I say this, difficult weekend. The caucus in Nevada? Woo! 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 But before we get to that, where do we begin? Every single day between now and the election. We begin with the words of Colonel Vindman. And I want to remind everyone that I just heard someone say on MSNBC, there are actually a lot of Colonel Vindmans out there. But you don't know about them. And of course, Donald Trump is probably got his hit list and he'll try to find every one of them. And every one of them will be given the perp walk out of the White House. The question is, what the hell will be left in the White House and the administration other than rot? But these are the words of Colonel Vindman as he testified, assuring his father that he will be all right. But of course, we all know unless we get rid of Donald Trump, not only will he not be all right, but either will the rest of us.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Don't forget, we're going to have those words memorized by the November election, and you're going to hold Colonel Vindman in your head and your heart as you vote in 2020, as well as a whole cast of characters from the people that are being trashed at the DOJ to the rule of law disappearing in front of our eyes to what's happening with the deregulation, especially at EPA. There's just so much rot. I was going to start with something that was political, and I decided that, you know what? I saw this at the New York Times this morning, and I want to share this obituary with you. And it's a beautiful, beautiful obituary. Katherine Johnson dies at 101. Mathematician broke barriers at NASA. She was one of a group of black women mathematicians at NASA and its predecessor, who were celebrated in the 2016 movie Yes, of course, Hidden Figures. But listen to how this obituary begins. It's just freaking beautiful. They asked Katherine Johnson for the moon, and she gave it to them. Wielding little more than a pencil, a slide rule, and one of the finest mathematical minds in the country, Mrs. Johnson, who died at 101 on Monday, at a retirement home in Newport News, Virginia, calculated the precise trajectories that would allow Apollo 11 to land on the moon. In 1969, and after Neil Armstrong's history-making moonwalk, let it return to Earth. A single error, she well knew, could have dire consequences for craft and crew. Her impeccable calculations had already helped plot the successful flight of Alan B. Shepard, Jr., who became the first American in space when his Mercury spacecraft went aloft in 1961. The next year, she likewise helped make it possible for John Glenn in the Mercury vessel Friendship 7 to become the first American to orbit the Earth. Yet throughout Mrs. Johnson's 33 years in NASA's Flight Research Division, the office from which the American space program sprang, and for decades after, almost no one knew her name. Mrs. Johnson was one of several hundred rigorously educated, supremely capable, yet largely unheralded women who, well before their modern feminist movement, worked as NASA mathematicians. But it was not only her sex that kept her long marginalized and long unsung. Catherine Coleman Goebel Johnson, a West Virginia native who began her scientific career in the age of Jim Crow, was also an African-American woman. Again, I want to remind you that today, Catherine Johnson died at 101, the mathematician that broke barriers at NASA. And again, I'm going to end this obit, which I could not complete, but you have to read it. It's at the New York Times. They asked Catherine Johnson for the moon, and she gave it to them. Oh, God, what an obituary. Whoever wrote this, I love you. Anyway, it is our Rethink the Week, and we have some wonderful, wonderful guests on the line. I am very excited. We're going to be waiting for Dean Spiliotis, who is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University, to join us in studio. But until he arrives, joining us right now on the line are two fabulous guests. I'm not sure they know each other, but if they don't, I hope they get to know each other now. John Nichols writes for The Nation magazine. Welcome to the program, John.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you, Arnie.
And Sean Sebastian, what's your title now? And you're an activist in Iowa. You're from Ames. You have done so much in the course of your young life, but remarkable career. Just remind my audience exactly what you did, especially when it came to sort of the turnout in Iowa, which was somewhat disappointing, but the results, which were very, very interesting. Sean Sebastian, in like 1 minute, give us a bio of Sean today.
Well, I was a movement politics organizer for Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, which is the largest grassroots organization in Iowa. And now I am a senior strategist on the Rural Green New Deal, working across the Midwest.
Well, see, I knew this was the perfect person to call. So we have to start with Nevada. And I guess I'm going to start with you, John. Were you there or were you covering it from Wisconsin? I know this was just an interesting Saturday because it was everything that a lot of progressives were hoping for. An incredible turnout, a diverse turnout, and a group of union workers that looked at their union bosses and said, you know what? I want health care for everyone, not just for me. So I'm kind of curious as to your reaction to the results of Saturday.
Well, my reaction to the results of Saturday is that it was a transition moment in our politics. And you shouldn't turn to me for reaction, right? You sort of pause and look at how the whole of our media system, all of our media structure is reacting. Suddenly, on the basis of the Nevada result, you saw everybody talking about Bernie Sanders and everybody trying to figure it out. Not everybody giving credit where credit was due. Mind you, many people still trying to dismiss Sanders, trying to see him as, a sort of unexpected or unpredictable or unimaginable reality, when in fact what happened in Nevada was a play out of many, many years of organizing and activism.
Right.
And so you had a situation where Bernie Sanders ran well in Nevada 4 years ago and never really stopped endorsing candidates, coming in and campaigning, being a presence, and his supporters doing the same.
Yeah.
So then when you got to this Nevada caucus moment this time, and in the days before, you had all these reports that national pundits went wild about. Oh, you know, the Culinary Workers Union has been critical of him, or, oh, these folks are upset, or, oh, this or that or whatever. The truth is, people in Nevada knew the guy.
Yeah.
And as a result, you saw these remarkable images where in hotels on the strip, workers, union members were coming in, and it wasn't that they were rejecting their unionists.
No, of course.
They were simply saying, we can balance these thoughts in our head. We can appreciate our health benefits that have been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
But we also understand that all of us are, you know, one layoff, one firing, one downturn, one illness. Right. And so it was a this was a deep win.
So, Sean Sebastian, Sean, you've been an organizer for a long time, and I see what's happening with Bernie as like this slow burn that's been going on, and it's been going on for, I'd say, the last maybe 20 years, but I think it really began to sort of take hold after the 2008 economic meltdown, where what you saw was they were able to write checks to make Wall Street whole, even though they were responsible for the economic meltdown. And then you saw that not only did they make Wall Street whole, but they basically walked away from Main Street. Then you begin to see that even with the Affordable Care Act, that the Affordable Care Act was in some ways written by Big Pharma and Big Insurance to make sure they were maintaining their profits. And yes, more people were provided with health care, but look at how many people were left out. Look at what happened. And then you begin to sort of take a look at sort of the rise of Donald Trump, and you realize that Donald Trump, in part, was not just the result of the GOP. It was really the result of a Democratic Party that appeared to be more wedded to positive profit results for Wall Street than for the rest of us. So Bernie isn't a surprise. He's, I think, a reality of where a lot of people are in this country. But for some reason, the Republicans didn't give a crap, and the Democrats were blind to it. Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting the nail on the head right here about, like, the contest going on in the Democratic Party itself. Obviously, it's the moderates versus the progressive wing of the party, but it's also the kind of underlying ideology that undergirds that, where you see the moderates kind of trying to frame the problems that we're facing today as beginning and ending with Trump, as if everything in 2015 was completely hunky-dory, yeah, and everyone was fine until Trump came in and ruined everything, and if we replace Trump, then all our problems will go away, versus the progressive wing of the party, Sanders and Warren, pointing out the fact that our wages have been flat for 40 years, pointing out the fact that college tuition has gone up ridiculously, exponentially, just as healthcare costs have gone up exponentially. And those are decades-long trends that started long before Donald Trump. And you have those candidates pointing to those systemic issues. And I agree with you completely. Those came to a head in the 2008 financial crash, where the deregulation agenda of the new Democrats led by Bill Clinton was one piece of the way that they turned their back on the progressive coalition. Obviously, the 94 crime bill and mass incarceration,
yes,
welfare reform, and then the deregulation of Wall Street, which came to a head in 2008, I think has led to a steady drumbeat and the elevation of people like Bernie Sanders, who are saying, like, hold up, wait a minute here. Like, this is not just about Donald Trump. This is about an economic and political establishment that has run amok and has been taking advantage of working people for decades.
Okay,
and
so
that's what drives their candidacy.
So Dean Spiliotis has just joined us. Welcome to the program, Dean. Thank you
Ernie.
Much for joining our Rethink the Week.
Sure.
Again, he's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. So a couple of things we're reacting to sort of what happened in Nevada, which is an interesting thing. Now the question is this going to be continued into South Carolina? Are we going to see the same sort of response on Super Tuesday? And now we have, in an interesting way, we have the exact opposite of Donald Trump, where Donald Trump was the ratings god for the national media and the cable media, and they gave him maybe $2 billion in free media. I think Bernie's getting about $1 billion in negative media or no coverage, okay? I mean, it's kind of amazing. And in between the free media that Donald Trump got, the $2 billion, and the negative media that Bernie Sanders is getting, the question is Michael Bloomberg buying the media with the billions that he's going to be spending? We've got the three faces of Eve. I so love this campaign. It's going to be kind of exciting. But as I look at the reaction to Bernie Sanders, it is the most hostile, believe it or not, I think, is MSNBC. In a way, Fox News is saying nice things about him because that's what Donald Trump wants. CNN is trying to be somewhere in the middle of Fox News, but MSNBC is kind of like over the top. So here's what I posted on Facebook, Dean. Hey, Bernie, remember when Martin Luther King was labeled an agitator and a socialist, when Cesar Chavez was described as a communist threat, and Nelson Mandela a terrorist, and was actually on the terrorist watch list in the United States till 2008. So I just want everyone to know, as you hear all this language about Bernie, do you think, especially people maybe under the age of 40, do they give a crap about labels? Or do they actually look at their lives and their future and want to hear someone that actually speaks to that, Dean?
It depends on how far you drop below the age of 40. There is some data that shows that young people in particular, the 18 to 29-year-old demographic, not super concerned about particular labels. They're focused more on programs and kind of relevance to their lives. As you get a little older, up into the 40s and 50s, it's a little more ideologically based and a little less kind of programmatic in terms of, you know, not really caring about parties, just policy. Sanders' rise is really contingent upon the idea that he can bring in lots of voters who have previously been disengaged from the process. The results so far have been mixed. He wasn't able to do it in Iowa and New Hampshire. He did do it in Nevada, which I think is giving them some hope. The press on him is not going to be warm and snuggly for some time. Maybe if he's the nominee at some point. All the clips are already circling on social media of him, you know, complimenting Castro and talking about Moscow. And,
there's love letters to North Korea, though. You promise? Love letters.
We don't know.
Just want to make sure.
There's plenty of oppo to mine. But, you know, a lot of the discussion has actually shifted more towards keeping the House and regaining the Senate rather than how would he be as a presidential nominee. I think at some level, given that Trump was able to win, people aren't really sure what would happen with Bernie at this point.
You know, exactly.
Maybe he might win, but the question is what's going to be the impact on suburbs, swing states, tight Senate races? That's where a lot of the angst now has shifted.
So I want to go back to something Sean said, but I want to turn to you, John Nichols. So Sean was talking about sort of the new Democrats. Now, remember, you know this better than anyone, John. I ran with Bill and Hill. I ran with Bill and Hill in 92, and I ran with Bill and Hill in 96. So I know their agenda better than anybody on the planet because I heard it before anybody else heard it, given the fact they were rolling out in 1991. And one of the things that you heard from Sean Sebastian was the things that sort of happened under Bill Clinton. You know, the crime bill, the welfare reform bill, the deregulation of derivatives, Glass-Steagall, the repeal of Glass-Steagall. As I'm hearing this, you know how I described it in the 1990s? That Bill Clinton was a Republican wet dream. So the problem is that when you describe Bill Clinton that way in the 1990s and you remind people of what Bill Clinton did, I have to ask you, John Nichols, was that the Democratic Party? Was that like our values? Was that what we wanted? I mean, did anybody realize what Bill Clinton was doing? It wasn't that, you know, the Democrats voted necessarily to change, but Bill Clinton was successful in morphing the Democratic Party into something that looked more like the GOP of you know, a moderate GOP than it had anything to do with the Democratic Party that I joined when I was 15 years old. John?
You're asking a core question. And the fact of the matter is that we don't have a media in the United States that knows how to cover politics.
That's probably
true. We haven't for a long time. This is a decades-long problem. We have a media that knows how to cover personalities. Mm. And so whatever personality happens to have the Democratic Party at a certain point is overwhelmingly portrayed in our media as the Democratic Party. And the problem with that is that then those Democrats who dissent are seen as outliers or are portrayed as somehow damaging figures. And it is important to remember that when Bill Clinton proposed a dumbed-down, overly complicated healthcare reform in 1993.
Managed competition.
Right,
even
right.
I remember that.
just a horror. It was painful even to read. when he proposed this reform, as opposed to single payer, massive numbers of Democrats in the House signed on for Jim McDermott's single payer bill.
Yeah.
When he proposed NAFTA and worked with Newt Gingrich and others to pass free trade at that point, a huge number of Democrats in the House opposed that move. When he did China free trade in 2000, similarly. And so there was always opposition. In fact, there was always much more opposition than most of our media portrayed. The problem, though, is that over time, when our media portrays the personality as the party, you begin to see a fraying of the party, a losing of its sort of infrastructure and sense of self. And that is where I think we're at right now, which is a very complicated moment. because what Sanders is proposing, and to some extent what Elizabeth Warren is proposing, and certainly what the Squad and people like that are proposing, what a lot of people are beginning to suggest is that they actually want to reconstitute a Democratic Party rooted in FDR values, or at least some of them, in very progressive values and ideals. And you see the media, so much of the media that is so obsessed with personalities, say, you can't do that. That's not right. That's dangerous. That's wrong, because that's a values-based politics. That's an idealism-based politics, and somehow that's dangerous.
So I want to go back to Sean now, because we'll wrap up a bit of this conversation. But Sean, you know, Dean, you made a really good point. Dean made a point about the fact that in Iowa, there wasn't this huge surge in young people. There wasn't the expansion of the base. And that's always been my argument about
and
why.
And even with a larger vote in New Hampshire, you didn't see that kind of movement.
Right, right.
When you look at the margins.
Can I just clarify, covered the Iowa vote?
Yep.
There was a huge surge in youth turnout.
Where? No, Sean.
It's in the data. Yeah.
Oh, no, hold on, yeah. Sean. So let me, Sean, you were there. This is your home. I'm going to talk to you. You're the Iowa expert. Here's what I read. What I read, and disabuse me of this, is that, yes, the percentage of the voters that were represented by young people was up to about 24%. It was a significantly higher than what had been a percentage before. The problem is, in 2008, there was such a bigger turnout that 24% of a smaller number is no cigar when you have like 19% of a bigger number. So I guess I'm going to ask you, Sean, because you were there on the ground, you saw the organizing, you know what happened in places like Iowa State and, you know, the University of Iowa. Where were young people, and why didn't they see the connection? Because while 24% is a nice percentage, it's not a nice percentage when there's such a fewer number of people that show up, and they should have been at 30% of that smaller number. Why didn't they come? Was it voter suppression? Was it confusion? Was it they couldn't make up their mind? What was your rationale for what it was, why they weren't capable of delivering? Because they've now been the storyline, actually, ever since we left Iowa, is that he couldn't expand the base.
Well, I think that I think Dina's right. Like, the numbers didn't bear out in terms of voter turnout in Iowa, where there was a much larger upside in a more diverse state like Nevada. There were those numbers, right? And this goes back to the structural problems with how we choose our candidate, right? We start our contest in Iowa and New Hampshire, two of the smallest and whitest states in the country. You know, like Iowa and New Hampshire combined account for 1% of the population, and a particularly like white part of the population as well. And you come to Nevada, where it's far more diverse. There is a far greater Latino population, and you see the kind of theory of change that Sanders is putting out actually come into fruition, where there isn't as much of an upside in Iowa and New Hampshire. Another thing that's on the ground is that a lot of people were like, you know, we want to get rid of Trump. A lot of these people are great. I'm not feeling like super motivated to show. I may not be super motivated to choose one of these candidates right now, although I believe they will be motivated to get rid of Trump in the end. I think that, like, obviously there is still a lot of work to do in places like Iowa, but I think we're going to upside much more as we move to more diverse states, like in South Carolina on Super Tuesday. We're going to see what we saw in Nevada a lot more.
Okay, so Dean, I'm going to just say something to you, because I was watching Elizabeth Warren in Seattle before hundreds of thousands of people. And the numbers, I don't know.
It was a nice turnout.
It was a big turnout. Yeah,
she was relieved, you can tell.
Right. Everybody was happy. Anyway, so I'm watching this speech, and what I know.
Seattle's her happy place, as we know from earlier in her campaign.
Yeah, I think it would be my happy place, too. I keep telling my daughter to move to Seattle. Anyway, so I'm watching her give this speech, and the numbers come out for Bernie. Yeah. And Bernie clearly clobbers everyone by more than 2-1 in the win in Nevada. And it was spectacular. And she announces it to her audience. And what I loved about that announcement is that everybody roared and screamed in approval, like, yay! And I thought that spoke volumes, not only about who she is, but about the people that are supporting her, and also about the fact that they could celebrate even though it wasn't their candidate or their choice, because what they were celebrating wasn't even just Bernie. It was the ideas that Bernie represented. And I think that's the thing that maybe the national media, as you heard John say, you know, they don't know how to cover politics. They know how to cover personalities. And you know what? I mean, Bernie could be a tree stump, but if the tree stump said, we got to fix health care with universal health care, we have to deal with the student debt issue and get rid of the student debt so that we don't have the anti-dowry. We have to make sure that kids can go to college and not have to fear if they have to drop out because they have to get a job. I mean, it's like it really is about the issues. And when I watch that Warren crowd, that's what kind of gave me hope that that's really what carries the day. Or am I just being sort of a naive liberal?
We've talked a number of times about the overlap, that there certainly is a significant overlap in the desired constituencies for both Warren and Sanders. But, you know, she hasn't been in double digits since Iowa. I mean, I think the latest I saw in Nevada was like 9.8%, and she was single digits in New Hampshire as well. So, you know, I'm not surprised to see that her supporters are warming to Sanders. I think they still believe that there is some longer-term strategy that they can play. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But just to go back real quick to the earlier issue, just so we're all on the same page, I think we are.
Yep.
You know, the issue is that if Sanders is going to lose, if he's going to lose moderates, suburban Republican women who don't like Trump, I mean, that's the theory anyway, that he's going to lose those folks, he's got to make it up with lots of other kinds of people.
Yep.
And while the percentage for those people increased, as we were saying, in Iowa and New Hampshire, you got to build a bigger pie with those people. So it's not
the answer. Right. I got the answer. All right, so John Nichols, Sean Sebastian, Rethink the Week, Dean Spiliotis, when we come back, I'm going to give you the answer to ensure not only that Bernie Sanders, he has to win it himself. But once he wins, I have the answer for 2020 in November. You're going to just have to wait and listen, okay? Trust me, this is genius.
Excellent.
All right, a little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Artie Artisan.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Drug and Hospital Employees Union Local 1199 sent a telegram to President Lyndon Baines Johnson. The message declared the union's stand against U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. They were the first union local to take an official stand against the war. However, it should not have surprised anyone that Local 1199 was willing to take such a public stand. From their founding, they have been deeply committed to broad social justice unionism. The union started in 1932 in New York City. In the beginning, their membership was mostly Jewish men working in drugstores. During their first decade, they led pickets for a living wage and against segregation. During the 1950s, they held organizing drives in the city's not-for-profit hospitals. This brought many African American and Latino women into the union. These workers were often paid wages as low as $32 per week and worked extremely long hours. The union helped them win a $100 a week minimum wage. The union had become an important voice for workers in the city's nonprofit hospitals. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called Local 1199 the authentic conscience of the labor movement. The union expanded its organizing beyond New York in 1969. They helped organize a successful strike of hospital workers in Charleston, South Carolina. From there, they launched organizing campaigns of hospital workers in other states. Over the years, the union has stood in solidarity with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta's efforts to organize farm workers. They opposed apartheid in South Africa. They were also an early opponent of the war in Iraq. Today, the local is affiliated with SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. To clear brush and briars from overgrown land, many people turn to heavy equipment. But Aaron Steele takes a different approach.
It's not just a novelty, it actually works.
Steele is the founder of Goats on the Go. The Iowa-based company sets up portable fencing, trucks in a herd of goats, and lets them munch away.
Despite their reputation of being tin can eaters, they actually have some pretty strong preferences. And fortunately for us and our customers, they prefer woody brush species and broadleaf weeds.
Steele says grazing is better for the soil than other methods of clearing land, and it reduces the need for heavy machinery.
So we're burning less fuel, putting fewer greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Steele eventually sells the goats for meat.
We like to think that we produce and sell the most sustainable meat on Earth. Goat meat demands little in resources anyway, but the way our goats are raised, we're feeding them on vegetation that is a waste otherwise.
Goats on the Go launched in 2012. It's been so successful that it now has franchises in 10 states. That's about 2,000 hungry goats helping landowners reduce their climate impact. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hey, I'm going to tell y'all the same thing Sonny Lance Lamb been trying to tell you for years. Be careful how you vote. Autumn say one thing, President say the same. If I don't know how much money you got, can you play that game? How long? One of you people, please be careful how you vote.
Oh, I think this is my theme song, Be Careful How You Vote. Ooh, fantastic, fantastic, by Chicago Bo. I've never heard of Chicago Bo, but I think I have to start following Chicago Bo. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson. It's our Rethink the Week. Joining us by phone is John Nichols of The Nation magazine, Sean Sebastian now with the Green New Deal, the rural kind of version of that. So thank you, Sean Sebastian from Iowa. And in studio is Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar. All right, so John Nichols, you're the writer in the family. So I want you to hear my solution for what happens assuming Bernie Sanders wins the nomination. You ready? So here's what happens. You always talk about balancing the ticket. And when you balance the ticket, you're sending a message. I get it. I want to be an inclusive party. I want to speak to everyone. This is really about all of us. I want to heal the Democratic Party. I want to heal the country. So who would fit that bill to an incredible T? But Michelle Obama. Now, let me, just hold tight. I want you to, just hush everybody. So now what we know is, now everyone's laughing at me. Stop laughing. Now, this is hard for me to say because she has no record of ever elected officials. I know all the garbage. So Michelle Obama is, first of all, the most admired woman in the world. She is still the most admired woman in the United States. Michelle Obama, unlike Barack Obama, actually has a history of coming from the slave experience in the South. Okay, she's from Chicago. Her father was, I think, a public sector worker, so she has a really interesting bio. But more importantly, this is. And I know in her autobiography, John, she said she would never run for public office ever. She watched what happened to Barack, and she realized this is horrible. This is horrible. So let me tell you my pitch to Michelle Obama, and to some extent my pitch to Barack Obama, because I read the piece in The Atlantic about the testy relationship between Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders, and I get it. But he also said that if Bernie won, he would do everything. So my pitch is that it's not just that we need Michelle Obama in order to heal and shut up the MSNBCs and all the crazy people on that station, from the Stephanie Rules to the Chris Matthews, who I want to give a knuckle sandwich to. But the reason I want Michelle Obama to consider doing this is not for the good of the country. Let me tell you what my pitch is to her, John. It's to protect her husband and her children. Because we know that if Donald Trump wins again, he's obsessed with Barack Obama. He is looking at, in every way, shape, or form. He talked about arresting Hillary Clinton. He will do everything in his power to not only undo, which is what he's already doing, that anything that Barack Obama touched, but I think that he will try to harm him. I really do. And I want to appeal to Michelle and say, you love the country, I get it. You admire your spouse, I get it. You want what's good for the future, I get it. But I want to talk as wife to wife and as mother to mother. This is also personal for you because this man is so over the top and so evil and so able to manipulate everything that even smells like justice. You do this because it's essential that he gets removed, and you will make sure that Bernie Sanders really has a voice that includes all of us and says, you know what? We need to move forward as a nation, not just as my base, but as a nation. So now, John, you can give me a knuckle sandwich, tell me to go into therapy, do whatever you want. But this is what I think, because I am that afraid, John.
Okay, Arnie.
All right.
I think there's a couple things there. First off, I don't anticipate that the current president would harm the former president.
I'm not.
That he will say horrible things and potentially harm the legacy, but I don't see that as something that would frame the debate going forward. And I don't think that Michelle Obama would see it in that way, although I can't speak for her.
Mm-hmm.
What I would tell you is this. There's a tendency to do this in our politics, and it goes back a long way. And that is to say that when you've had a leader who has had political success, that their spouse, who is also a very accomplished person, might step up, mm-hmm. right, and carry forward. We saw this in the aftermath. It's almost lost to history now, but we saw this in the aftermath of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency when
Eleanor
Roosevelt was an incredibly beloved figure.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when Eleanor Roosevelt was actually right about the issues in ways that Harry Truman never was, when Eleanor Roosevelt was right about the issues in ways mm-hmm. that Adlai Stevenson never was, there were a lot of people who said, boy, I wish she was running. And but the counsel I would give you is this.
And that's why I'm saying it out loud now. I need counsel because I want public therapy is what I'm looking for here.
People are going to put their opinions out, and that's very and wiser people than I have put their opinions out about many of these things. But here's the one thing I would say. What you're aiming at here is the idea of the vice presidency as a critical factor in all this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Michelle Obama's made clear that it is not her desire to be a presidential candidate or a vice presidential candidate.
Right.
And I think she's been very firm in that, and she ought to be respected in it mm-hmm. rather than, I understand your desire to make an appeal and more power to you. But what I would say is she's been pretty clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
What I would suggest is that a deeper focus on the vice presidency is quite appropriate. And here's my view. I think that in choosing a vice president, the nominee of the party, whoever that is, and I think this issue is still up for grabs. We must remember that 98% of the country hasn't voted
mm-hmm.
yet, or roughly 98%. But in choosing vice president, the genius move in vice presidential picks is to recognize that your first task is to win the election, mm-hmm. not to figure out how you're going to, get along once you're elected.
Right.
And in 2016, Hillary Clinton chose Tim Kaine, an honorable man who had a lot to recommend him, but who wasn't a particularly exciting or effective candidate mm-hmm. for the vice presidency. She chose someone she could govern with, someone she wanted to work with, but not someone who actually contributed a great deal.
Right.
The last thing I'll just say about vice presidential picks is this. If you want to look at the people who actually made their move, right, and made their big steps on it throughout history. You look at Franklin Roosevelt in 1940, where he brought Henry Wallace in to consolidate the left. You look at John Kennedy in 1960, where he brought Lyndon Johnson in to bring a portion of the establishment and also a portion, a guy from Texas. You look at Ronald Reagan in 1980, who picked the guy who had, coined the term voodoo economics as his running mate, right?
Yeah.
And this is the deeper reality of picking a vice president. You may get a very prominent person. You could, and that's always good. But at the heart of it you have to pick someone who can help you fill in the gaps, who can help you actually win an election.
So I
don't think Democrats have thought that way for a long time.
So
I think it has haunted them.
So I did something while you were talking, and I know she has no history, and I know that she may not want this, and I get all that, and I agree with you. I mean, part of me is just – I'm trying to figure out what the olive branch is. I'm trying to figure out how to heal. I'm trying to let people know that Sean, I know Bernie Sanders since he was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, okay? And you know what? Here's what I've told people. When he was the mayor, he compromised. When he was a member of Congress, he compromised. When he was a member of the United States Senate, he compromised. He talks about passing more of the amendments to bills. You know what the amendments were? They were compromises. Let me remind everyone. And that part of him never gets celebrated. And I go back to some of the most amazing women that we've ever elected, like Margaret Chase Smith. Guess how she got there, Sean? Her husband died. It's not uncommon for women historically to go in, not because they had a political record. You know, I mean, that was the old fashioned way. We didn't show up. We happened to have the right last name and married to the right guy, you know, and it didn't mean that Margaret Chase Smith isn't remembered today as one of the most remarkable human beings we could have ever had elected. But that's how she ended up getting there. So as I'm looking at this, Sean, what I'm trying to figure out is that we can look at the Abraham Lincoln approach, which was bring your enemies close. Or we can look at how we balance the ticket. But I want people to know that what Bernie Sanders is, having watched him throughout his whole career, is not what the media has painted. And while he has got a vision that I totally believe in, he also knows that governing is not a switch that goes on and off. Am I crazy, Sean?
No, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I think that that's why the slogan for the campaign is not me, us, because he not only understands the importance of compromising, as you said, in his governing record, but he understands the role of social movements in actually pushing forward the legislation that we need, right? Like the Civil Rights Act, the whole wave of civil rights legislation did not happen because Lyndon Johnson was a great guy. It happened because of movements outside putting pressure. The same is true with FDR and the New Deal. There was a huge amount of pressure from outside movements to make those things happen. I think that's another unique piece that Bernie brings to the race, is he understands the role of social movements in working an inside-outside game to actually make real change happen. And I think, to your point about the vice presidency, I do think that what John said is absolutely right. We need to be thinking about this more strategically for the election, like who can help win the election. I think, Arnie, your instinct is right that a Black woman would be an important addition to the presidential ticket. I don't think it doesn't necessarily need to be Michelle Obama for the reasons John said. But I mean, there's a lot of amazing, great Black women legislators, including Stacey Abrams.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes.
I'm
passing the torch to you.
Thank you. There's sort of different things going on here.
Filio.
So let me ask for a point of clarification. Arnie,
yes.
You talked about, I mean, everybody's giving Bernie a lot of credit. You're talking about him extending an olive branch. To whom would he be extending that olive branch? To moderates who don't like him? To the African-American community or the Latino community? But he's already getting more Latino support. I guess my question is, in the midst of his revolution, are we saying that he's going to pick a VP who's a fine establishment Democrat or a moderate? Or is he going to pick a progressive that comes out of either the African-American or Latino community? I don't understand.
So let me just say something. This is going to sound totally quirky, you guys, so just please forgive me for this. I'm running for governor. And, John, when I'm running for governor, there is a libertarian woman named Miriam Luce on the ticket, okay? Mm-hmm. And Miriam Luce actually gets more votes than any libertarian ever in history. And I got to hang out with Miriam and the GOP Republican Steve Merrill for months because we were running together. And so I got to sort of admire them. And you're going to be shocked at what I'm going to tell you. There was about a time for maybe a 2 week, maybe 14 minutes where it looked like I could actually beat Steve Merrill. I mean, it was very short, but it was whatever. And as I was walking off a debate stage with Miriam, I looked at Miriam and I said, Miriam, if I become governor, we don't have lieutenant governors in New Hampshire, John Nichols. But I said, if I become governor, would you consider being on my staff, maybe even chief of staff? And Miriam Luce. Look, now, remember, I am the most progressive liberal person to have won anything up until that point in time. And you know me, John, so you know exactly what my policies were. And Miriam looked at me and she said, why the hell would you want me, Arnie? And I said, because I want someone in my office that would look at me and challenge me and say, are you sure you need that program? Defend it. I didn't want a yes, sir. I didn't want someone who would kiss my butt. I didn't want someone. I wanted the tension of making sure that as I was approaching my very conservative red state, that I was constantly appreciating where they had come from, where I thought they needed to go, and how we needed to sort of approach the language and the selling of the programs I was talking about. And in a lot of ways, I go back to Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln did not look at those people that opposed him necessarily as his enemy. He understood that their perspectives were not a threat, but might, in fact, enrich his ability to move the country forward.
Just to be clear, so we're talking olive branch like Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, or are we talking Stacey Abrams or somebody else?
Well, John, you answer that.
Well, I mean, I also let other folks answer too, but let me offer this notion. You, in talking about bringing your libertarian rival into your administration, are speaking a language that a lot of Americans want to hear. They like this idea of a team of rivals. They like having that sort of discourse. But remember, that is a post-election decision, right?
Right.
That is not about winning an election.
Right. Right.
And maybe if you'd talk about it on the campaign trail,
But
you understand what I'm saying, though. Right. That in picking a vice president, what you want to do is figure out how to win an election. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that if Bernie Sanders picked someone who was too much a part of the establishment, who was too closely tied to the Democratic establishment, which he has criticized, that would not help him, I would argue. Mm-hmm. While his base is very, very loyal, there would be people who would say, and you know, including maybe Donald Trump, who would say, hey, look, you know, there he is selling out, or there he is compromising, or there he is, you know, going too far, mm-hmm. you know, away from his basic concepts. But I don't think that necessarily excludes a political calculus, because the fact of the matter is there are tremendous progressives in the African American and Latinx community, and there's a tremendous number of women who are frankly ready to run and ready to govern. Mm-hmm. And so, when you get into this situation, right, and you start to make your choice, Bernie Sanders has an opportunity to look at a lot of people who have potential to bring strength to that ticket.
Right.
And he can do it in one of two ways. Again, we're not saying Sanders is the nominee, because I think, I keep emphasizing, 98% of the country still to vote in this primary process. But when he does this, if it is him, then you know he has to make a choice, and this is the core of that choice. It is, do you make a pick who has a kind of a national resonance, someone who people across the country are going to tap into, and it may benefit you in a bunch of states, right? Mm-hmm. Or do you make a regional pick who might help you to advance in a group of states that you need to prevail?
Pennsylvania, and the simplest way to Wisconsin, Michigan. Who's lived in all three?
Here's a way to look at it, right? If you're going to try and make a play for Georgia and maybe North Carolina and some other southeastern traditionally southern states, which are rapidly changing, then, you know, Stacey Abrams has relevance as a national pick, mm-hmm. appeal there, but also somebody who brings some regional strength. If you're going to look at the upper Midwest, right, mm-hmm. might you look at somebody like Tammy Baldwin, the senator from Wisconsin, who keeps winning even in Republican years, is an out lesbian who has a pretty progressive record. Yeah. If you're going to, you know what I mean? You start looking the Southwest,
if
you're going to make a play for Arizona and maybe even Texas, do you look at someone from there who has a progressive record? You don't compromise on the basic premises, the basic values, but you may look in different ways and at different people to achieve different goals.
All right, I'm going to change the topic just because I saw an article, Sean Sebastian, at The Intercept that doesn't surprise me but completely makes me apoplectic. Ginni Thomas plans new conservative supergroup to protect President Trump. And, of course, we're talking about Supreme Court Justice Thomas's wife. And I want to start with this. Conservative activist Virginia Ginni Thomas is launching yet another project to wage war on multiple fronts of America's most heated cultural and political debates. This time, however, her plan will include a project to protect President Trump using at least two new campaign-related political entities, according to a presentation obtained by The Intercept and documented. I am looking at the appointment of the judges with Donald Trump. I am looking at a Supreme Court where Sotomayor was so upset, she actually wrote something in her dissent about what she is seeing with the ability of this court to basically sort of genuflect to Donald Trump as opposed to sort of protect the interests of the American people. And I look at this and I'm thinking, how do we use this and explain to people this is like beyond wrong? And it is tainting everything we know about the three branches of government. And maybe we need to have someone, because it's the court itself that establishes its rule of conduct. Maybe we need to begin to establish the rule of conduct for apparently a Supreme Court that is not capable of understanding what is more than the appearance of impropriety, but frankly, I think is impropriety.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this also, what you're bringing up, is the level of degradation of norms that yes. is bleeding into, like, really undermining Thank the you. Basic rule of law here. And I think this in and of itself is something that can be a very compelling argument for those moderates who are fence-sitting and who have a lot of anxiety about Bernie Sanders, because something that Republicans completely understand the importance of. It's always their first priority. And in fact, I think it's one of the most understudied and underfocused on stories of the Trump presidency is the massive transformation of the judiciary that we will potentially be living with for a generation. Like, this is something that we as Democrats, no matter where you are on the Democratic spectrum, moderate, progressive, liberal, whatever, like, we cannot afford to have another 4 years of Donald Trump. So you may have your problems with Bernie Sanders, you may be skeptical about him, but there is a lot at stake here. And if it's not, you know, if you're skeptical about healthcare, if you're skeptical about the student debt crisis, and the environmental crises, which I think are deep existential crises, even if you're skeptical about that, look at what is happening to the judiciary. And the Ginni Thomas example is something that is horrifying, that is the tip of an iceberg, where there is so much that is happening below the surface in terms of transformation of the judiciary that really, really has to stop. And no moderate, no Democrat at all, no moderate can afford to sit on the sidelines just because they have a distaste for Bernie Sanders. At the very least, if you care about the rule of law, if you care about the integrity of our judiciary, this is a do or die moment, no matter who the nominee is. Yeah. And I think it's really an important argument to bring moderates on board.
So I don't know the answer to this, but how does Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts watch this and protect the institution he loves, Dean Spiliotis? He's not a moderate. There's no question about this. I'm not asking what part of the spectrum he's on.
Sure.
But when it comes to protecting his institution, we've always known that she's played in this arena. That has been long known to a lot of people.
Yeah, she's been
very active. But this is sort of taking it to an extreme.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we believe that Roberts is an institutionalist, really the only two ways he can have an influence is either through public statements, which he has done on occasion, or some working it into his decisions in some way, or the nature of the decisions. I mean, that's really his decision, the Obamacare decision, was really kind of
yes.
the pivot point for how people viewed him.
Right.
You know, and we'll see where it goes from here. It's hard to know.
John Nichols, Sean Sebastian, Dean Spiliotis, we should have 3 hours. Thank thank you so much for joining us for the Rethink the Week. Don't forget Ginny Thomas. This is an important story. I want to make sure everybody remembers it. And again, I want to thank you so much. Thank you, guys.
All right.
Take care.
Way back when, in the beginning of time, man made the fire, then the wheel went from a horse to an automobile. He set the world in mind. He took the oceans and the sky. He set the borders, built the walls. He won't stop till it owns it all. Disaster. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. I know the answer. Put a woman in charge. Put the woman in charge. Put a woman in charge. Put the woman in charge. We'll be right back.